Turning our attention now to maps and cartography, the history of cartography, actually, with Matthew Edney, who's director of the History of Cartography Project in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The project produces the multi-volume History of Cartography series. It's an examination of maps in the context of the societies that made and used them. Matthew is also one of the audio commentators in an exhibit that traces 300 years of Wisconsin and Great Lakes maps. And that's on display through the end of June in the Department of Special Collections at Memorial Library on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Really pleased to have Matthew come by. And if you have some questions or comments for him as we move along, you're certainly most welcome to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890. We'd love to have you come on with your own questions about cartography and about maps. And pleased to have him with us. And certainly, Matthew, you've had welcome to the program first.
Thank you.
I was reading a little biography on you, and you've had a kind of a long and winding road for you to arrive here at the University of Wisconsin. You were here and sort of circled back.
Yes, I was here as a grad student back in the 80s, did my master's and PhD here. And I've just come back a couple of years ago to take over the project.
Mm-hmm. What is it that attracted you to maps?
I don't know. What I can remember is when I was about 4 years old, begging my mother for sheets of kitchen vellum, greaseproof paper, as we call it in Britain, and I would just trace out maps from atlases. I can remember staring at some atlases in my father's house, my father had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. They just grabbed me. And so when I went to college, I chose a program that would also allow me to study land surveying.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of kept on going from there.
Kept going from there. And your master's and PhD are both from the UW-Madison,
yeah.
If I'm not mistaken,
yeah.
in cartography.
Master's in cartography, PhD in geography.
Well,
technically speaking.
I was thinking back. I was talking to my producer, Jim Packard, before the show, and I said, Jim, do you remember the athlete who was so interested in maps? And it was turned out he remembered Andy Kowski, who was a basketball player here,
ooh,
who had maps. And every time they traveled anywhere, he always knew a lot about the place they were visiting or places they were visiting because of the maps. And as a matter of fact, as Jim reminded me, on more than one occasion, saved the charter bus because the driver didn't quite know where they were going, but Andy always knew
because he had the map.
Mm-hmm. and he studied them. And what is it about maps? And I'm going to go to the phones here in a second. We got Walter, we'll get to you in just a second here from Hortonville. But what is it about maps? You're quoted as saying maps are part of the way we create meaning in the world and partly define the way we think about the world.
Well, if you think about the world is an incredibly complex place, and maps are one way. I mean, there's all sorts of other ways we do it, but mm-hmm. maps are one way in which we try to simplify that complexity, to sort of mm-hmm. take out the crucial parts of the world that have meaning to us or mm-hmm. which we think of meaning. And so it's a way. So maps are a way to help us understand the world, to get rid of all the extraneous matter and come down to the nubbin. Whether it's a map about navigation, how do we get from A to B? Whether it's a map about the distribution of trees or of other kinds of vegetation. Whether it's a map of states, where are places at a very sort of low resolution? What's the nature of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Is it flat? Is it round?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a dodecahedron?
Mm-hmm. So it does help us define the way we think about the world as well.
Exactly, in the sense that when you think about a world map, none of us have ever seen the world.
Right.
And even if we're fortunate enough to go up into space, we'd only ever see at most half of the world directly. Mm-hmm. The world, the world map gives us a view of the world, and in fact, most people think of the world when they think of the whole mm-hmm. Earth in terms of world maps, broken mm-hmm. down into continents. Mm-hmm. Why continents? Why is Europe a separate continent? It's just an appendage of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's continually has been mapped as a separate area, deserving of its own maps, it has a certain status, a certain privilege, mm-hmm. akin to Africa, North or South America, Asia, Australia, and so on. Maps help us give us concepts with which to deal with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not a simple case of the map maker sort of creating these concepts and then foistering them onto the map reading public. Is more of a give and take,
mm-hmm.
because very much maps are made for certain people. Most maps have always been have either been commissioned by people in a sort of a governmental or authoritative role, or they've been made for a general public. So you can't make maps for general public if they don't meet the expectations that the general public has about what maps should be. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
You began by talking about roadmaps.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that Rand McNally, National Geographic Society, all the other people who make atlases of the United States for road navigation, why do they all have the maps structured by states? So you go mm-hmm. alphabetical
sure.
through the states. So when you're on a small road and you cross a state boundary, you've got to flip through the atlas to get to the next state. And then if the next state is substantially different in size from the one you're in,
mm-hmm.
then you change the scale of the map dramatically. It's mm-hmm. very weird. It's not rational. It's not standard. The reason is because Americans, when Americans started to make atlases, first one in 1795, right after independence, it was a time when the states still had a great deal of authority as sovereign entities. And so the first American atlas actually has no map of all of the United States. It's just a series of maps of individual states.
Oh.
Organized in geographical sequence, starting with the District of Maine, still wasn't a state at the point, going down through New England and down the coast, and then into the interior. And this has set an expectation of how United States atlases should be structured. So in the 19th century, you get a couple of guys coming in from Europe at various times. Nor I know most is a guy called Henry Schenck Tanner, German immigrant, who in the 1850s said, surely it would be more logical to have a map
of the whole
an atlas in which every map has the same scale.
Oh.
So you can do direct comparisons between areas. And he did this at very small little pocket atlases. He did on very large folio atlases, all of which only went through one edition, which suggests they just didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas all of the other atlases, state by state by state, one state on a uniform size of paper, those atlases went through edition after edition after edition after edition. And even today, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there have been people who've tried to do the same thing with roadmaps, road atlases, to have standardized size, standardized scale mm-hmm. running throughout, as you'll find in roadmaps, road atlases of Britain or France or Germany, anywhere in Europe. And they never sell.
Interesting.
Because they don't meet expectations.
Walter in Hortonville, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a 1931 German atlas, world atlas.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there?
Yes, yep. Go ahead.
All right, and I just come across it recently in a home that I purchased. And I was wondering if there would be somebody around that might be interested in it. It's the Total World Atlas from 1931.
As a standard rule of thumb, any university map library is always interested in acquiring new materials.
Mm-hmm.
So the University of Madison Map Library is in Science Hall on the third floor. We'd be very interested if you want to consider donating it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of commercial cost, selling, and so on. There is actually a website called maphistory.info, I-N-F-O, which has a series of subordinate pages, one of which has a listing of map dealers. And if you go to them, they can maybe tell you how much it's worth.
Maphistory.info.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're talking today with Matthew Edney, director of the History of Cartography Project in the Department of Geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I want to talk with him some more about that project, obviously, and about the volumes that have been produced and those that are still to come. And we're certainly interested in hearing from you as well. So if you have some questions, give us a call, and we will be glad to get you on the air. And we'll be right back with our guest, Matthew Edney, after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. Talking about the history of maps today and cartography with Matthew Edney, director of the History of Cartography Project in the Department of Geography at the UW-Madison. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd be glad to get you on the air. And Christy in East Troy has been patiently waiting, so let's go to Christy. Hi, Christy. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi, Christy.
Hi. I just had a question. I've had several globes, and they never have a date.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to date. I've got one I think is really, I don't know, pretty old. Mm-hmm. And I just cannot find a date on any globe. How do you date globes?
It's a very good question. There are several ways, there's several factors involved. One is the nature of the materials, and to explain that will take way too long and can be very boring and technical. The easiest way for a non-expert, someone who doesn't know about the techniques of globe mapping, globe mm-hmm. making in particular, the simplest way is to look at the content and to start looking at the geographical outlines of countries.
Right.
So, for example, if you have a globe that shows the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then you know it must be made before 1918. If it shows Yugoslavia as an entity, then it must have been made before Yugoslavia broke up in the 80s, and so on. And if you...
The one that I have, it still has Indochina
mm-hmm.
instead of Vietnam.
Well, yeah, Indochina is the French colonial districts combining Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. So there you're looking at a globe that would have been made somewhere before 1960, probably. I'm not exactly sure when the French decolonized in that part of the world. If you look in Africa, you might mm-hmm. find that you'll find large areas like British East Africa, which doesn't become independent until 1962, and so on.
Sudan.
Right, Sudan is independent earlier. Mm-hmm. But I think one very nifty thing to do is to go to a local university library, and you'll find you'll have lots of old atlases in, mm-hmm. in the collections. You'll find you'll have lots of old encyclopedias in the collections. And they're normally grouped together. Mm-hmm. And so you can start pulling them off and start doing some comparisons, and you should be able to figure out what kind of roughly what date range you have for your globes.
Do you have any answer to why they don't provide that when they produce a globe?
Oh, yes. It's basically marketing. one of the crucial points about maps is maps tell you what the world is like. Now, you don't want to put out maps into the marketplace that are going to be quickly outdated. And so if you leave the date off, then you just sort of obscure the fact that this is a commercial product made for profit, and you promote the sense that this is a statement of geographic fact. Is a practice that goes way back into the, start of the commercial map publication period, which is the 16th century, late 15th.
It's Leroy Tolman, is it?
That I don't know.
use like almost every globe except for this little one that I've got. But
unfortunately, I'm not a great expert on globes. and globe makers, certainly not in the 19th and 20th centuries in the United States. But there are some reference works. There's a book called Tooley's Dictionary of Map Makers, which is a book that tries to catalog and identify the dates for most of the productive map makers over the last four or five centuries.
Hmm.
And you might find something there.
Thanks for calling, Christy. Appreciate it. John in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question I have are map reproductions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a traveler, world traveler, as well as around the country. And I'm doing a genealogical research on our family that came to Wisconsin before Wisconsin was a state.
Mm-hmm.
And in your department, is it possible to get some reproductions of older maps rather than have to go to books or whatever libraries so I can sit and look at them and follow routes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pardon me one second. Pardon me. There's a couple of ways of doing this.
I'm in Madison regularly.
That's not
a problem.
The high-tech way is probably the best way to go, is to go through various websites. And again, if you go to maphistory.info, which is not my own website, I hasten to add, there's also a wonderful listing there of sites which include lots of old maps, reproductions. And there's two sites in particular that I think you'll find useful. A former property developer in San Francisco called David Rumsey is in the process of scanning and putting on the web very high-resolution images of his entire collection, which is a phenomenal collection of 19th-century American maps. So if you go to David Rumsey, RUMSEY.com, you can find a lot of maps of Wisconsin in the early 19th century. He's mostly 19th century. The earlier periods, the Library of Congress, part of the American Memory Network, maintained by the Geography and Map Division of the LC, has a lot, again, of very high scale, very high resolution imagery of 19th and 18th, and even earlier maps, focusing again on North America. And there you can find all sorts of images and details of maps and things that you don't have to buy. And the nice thing about Library of Congress, it's, again, free for use because it's in public domain.
Mm.
As long as it's not in copyright, and most old maps are not. Otherwise, you'd have to identify particular maps and go to the library and get them to make a copy and stuff. And that depends upon the nature of the archive. My project does not keep old maps. You simply write about them. In Madison, the places to go would either be the map library, University Map Library, which is mostly contemporary modern mapping, or the State Historical Society of Wisconsin, which has a very large map library and very, very deep collections for Wisconsin. And also special collections in Memorial Library have a number of maps, not separately housed, but in books and atlases and things.
Mm-hmm. And they provide copies?
They can do.
Okay.
But then you've got to stop paying.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Okay. Just a quick end note. I was given a stamp collection when I was 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, foreign stamps, I had to know where these places were.
Right.
And that initially started me on maps.
Mm.
So I've been doing that the rest of
And actually, there's a subset of philately that is focused on maps that have stamp that have, sorry, that have that stamps that have maps on them.
Oh.
And there's some collectors out there who've built up some substantial collections. because if maps are something that you use to talk about your national territory, your national sovereignty.
Sure.
And stamps are a way to talk about national sovereignty. Then you put the two together, you have a very powerful statement.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It very much. And Corrine in Richland Center, we'll go to you next.
Hi there.
Hi.
I am glad
Hi.
To talk to someone like you. Would you believe at my age, I have done some map making of my own.
Cool.
Back in the 1980s, I numbered a small town. It had been platted in the 1800s. They even had the green metal signs up. But UPS and the rest of them didn't have to get to anybody's house. So the women's club went at it. They wrote to Madison and said, how do you number a town? Well, I know the town very well. It was very small. So I took out my newsprint one day and laid it on the table and decided, well, this town was a lot squared off than I thought it was. So I had to learn that I leave empty lots and things and old buildings that might get torn down so everyone had it. Actually, my work has followed me way over here to Richland County because probably where you are, because anything with a 994 telephone number is that it's in the town of Bloomington, Wisconsin, then my work has followed me. Now with the lady with the globes, I have been collecting globes and pull down maps from the old schools for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a globe last week, and you tell her, or she's listening, I found a 1956 underneath this globe, and I've learned how to clean them. I only pay $3 a piece for them. Nobody wants them anymore.
Well, they're very hard to to keep. One old map, one retired map curator from a national collection, likes to joke by saying that the best way to store globes is to just squash them flat, and then they'll fit in the drawers. That is, of course, not a reputable practice.
Oh, when I see these at $3 a piece at Rummy Sales, I had mine cleaned up before Sunday morning. I did it on my own, and I just use Q-tips and window cleaner and make sure it's clean and clean so it's, and then I wax it.
I'm not going to say that's a good practice or not, because I'm not a restorer. But I think there are some people who specialize in restoring globes. But of course, you pay a great deal of money for it. I'm not sure about waxing in the long term. You know, there's a practice in the 19th century of varnishing maps, of covering maps in globes for that matter, in a coating of varnish. I think, as far as I understand, because in gaslight, varnish glistens very nicely, has a very aesthetic look to it. And the problem now, 100, 150 years later, is that varnish has darkened and it solidifies. And so as soon as you have a large map, and this is also for mostly for wall maps that are put up for display that will be seen under gaslight. So as soon as you take these maps now and you move them a bit, the varnish cracks and it takes the paper with it. So one of the very first things you have to do if you find those big old wall maps from the 19th century of counties and of states, even of towns, the very first thing you really need to do is to remove the varnish. But of course, in the same time you do that, the very top layer of ink and color comes off. So sometimes you find maps that are really quite hideous looking because the varnish has been removed. But they're still better than a big brown blob that's completely illegible. So I'm saying that simply because the wax might, down the line, might start to fade and or darken and actually obliterate the globe down the line. My immediate sense would be is once you've got it clean, don't put anything else on top of it.
Yeah, good. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We've had several calls about the exhibit at the Memorial Library, and I mentioned it in passing, talk about that, please, for us.
Surely. The exhibit is called Making Maps, Mapping History, 300 Years of Original Maps, Wisconsin, the Great Lakes Region. And it was put together by a consortium of librarians and map librarians and regular librarians here at Madison and also at UW-Milwaukee. At the American Geographical Society collection there. And it covers essentially 300 years of Wisconsin Great Lakes history, focusing mostly on Wisconsin, starting with a map. I think the earliest map in the official exhibit is 1670, but the special collections support a couple of other maps for display that go back into the 1540s. And it's a very nice collection of maps showing how Wisconsin became created as a territory, both through defining boundaries between Wisconsin, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, but also through creating a territory, caller just now mentioned the town plats and stuff there. Mm-hmm. So there's a nice series of maps showing the progressive mapping through the, by the General Land Office of the Township and Range series, and then a whole series of further maps about how that then becomes the basis for mapping Wisconsin in a very easy manner. Why worry about details when you can just map a nice square grid? and the fact that the square grid isn't really a square grid is beside the point. So you can find all sorts of wonderful maps and sort of a very clear sense of the history of Wisconsin as a place, as a state which has meaning for its inhabitants and for anyone else in the United States.
And there's audio commentary.
Yes. It has there's a podcast or an iPod which you can rent. I think it's a free rental. You just got to, right. I think, store a deposit of some sort so you don't walk off with the iPod. and that has a commentary, audio commentary. I did some of it, and other experts at UW-Madison did other commentaries.
And that's on display through June 29th in the Department of Special Collections at the Memorial Library. So,
which is open 9 to 5.
9 to 5 every day?
Well, 10 to 5, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Monday through Friday, 9 to 5.
Yeah.
Also, I've had a question or two about the history of cartography project itself, the series, the books. Can you tell us about those books? What do we have so far, and what's in the works? There's a lot done, but there's a lot to be done as well.
Oh, yes. The History of Cartography Project was founded. It was conceptualized in 1977 by Brian Harley, who was then in University of Exeter, and David Woodward, who was then at the Newberry Library in Chicago. And they decided that what the field needed was a four-volume history of cartography that would provide a foundation. By the late 70s, there was a lot of interesting work being done, but there's also a lot of work that was, a lot of scholarship was just repeating itself. And the scholarship itself was scattered across multiple fields, from history of science and history technology, geography and cartography, straight history, anthropology, art history, and so on. And so they decided to create a new foundation to bring together all the literature and to summarize it, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the goal, I'd say, was four volumes to be done by 1992. And the Columbus Quincentennial seemed a nice marker. Well, what they actually did was, rather than solidifying an existing field, what they've actually done is establish a sort of a manifesto, as it were, a series of protocols for a whole new discipline. A discipline that studies maps not as statements of geographic fact or scientific documents, but as cultural documents, documents that are made and used by people for reasons, for specific reasons, so that the interest has dramatically expanded. And with that, the series has expanded. The volumes have grown much bigger than they were initially planned. Decided back in the early 80s to create a separate volume for traditional Asian cartographers. And in the initial conception, because they were thinking that what they were doing was summarizing existing literature, they didn't think this volume would be very large, because in European American scholarship, Asian cartography really hadn't figured much at all. So in a nice quick volume, and then we get onto the real stuff, the Renaissance and Enlightenment and stuff, and so on. Volume 2 grew into two books, each one bigger than Volume 1, simply because by starting to look at maps as cultural documents, you just open up the understanding of maps and how they relate to all aspects of human life. And so you end up with some phenomenal chapters on all sorts of aspects of Islamic, South Asian, East Asian cartographies that just really opened up everyone's eyes. And we followed that up with, we tacked on a third book to volume two to cover indigenous mappings. Mappings made by people who don't live in economically complex societies, covering the Americas, pre-European colonization, Pacific, Australia, Africa. That's volume two, book three, which again just blew people's minds even more because it starts to really probe this question, what is a map? In Maori societies, it's there are some traditional maps that comprise a handful of stones, where it's the process of picking up the stones and throwing them away that constitutes the map, rather than an actual solid, fixed, inscribed document. So this kind of work has worked us out so that maps have become more fluid documents than they ever were before, ever understood before. Because it also means that the project as a whole has expanded and sort of slowed down a bit. After volume two is volume three, which deals with European Renaissance and Reformation, 1450 to 1650, which itself is just a phenomenal period. This volume will appear in two bindings. It's huge for various reasons. And will appear this summer.
Out this summer.
I'm not going to say precisely when because that's going to jinx me. And right now it should be out in time for an annual, for the biennial International History of Cartography meeting in July, but it's getting very tight right now. It's a huge book.
And what are your, because we're running out of time here, I want to ask you, you have a website, I assume,
yes,
for this project, and I want to make sure that people know where they can go to find out more about it.
Surely. The website, which explains about the remaining three volumes that we have to do yet, which is, say, Volume 4, Enlightenment, Volume 5, 19th Century, Volume 6, 20th Century. That website can be found at geography.wisc.edu/histcart. Histcart, all one word. And you can also find us by finding the Department of Geography website at UW-Madison. We have a link straight from that homepage.
Well, this has been a pleasure. You know, we never got to the map jokes and a lot of other things as well, Matthew. So we'll have to have you back and do this again.
Surely. It's been fun.
Appreciate it very much. Matthew Edney, Director of the History of Cartography Project in the Department of Geography at the UW-Madison. Sorry we didn't get to everybody here, but that's the way it sometimes goes. We'll have him back and do it again. And just to let you know, tomorrow we salute Earth Week and Earth Day with Buddy Hoffaker and Steve Swenson of the Aldo Leopold Foundation and Cindy Hale of the Great Lakes Worm Watch at the University of Minnesota. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.